From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how the upcoming midterm elections could impact healthcare policy in Wisconsin and around the country.
Then designer Donna Rico has worked in the fashion industry for years, but one thing she's not a big fan of is the modern fashion show.
Back in the day, they were about the clothes and the beauty of them and the fabric and the way that, you know, they were worn. I think what's happened in a lot of cases today in a show, it's more about the pageantry.
Milwaukee Magazine's cultural editor helps preview the fall art season.
And how Wisconsin became an important place in the history of pickleball.
My wife, her eyes glaze over when I start talking about it because I get real enthused about it. Basically, for me, it's just a fun form of exercise. You know, it's a fun game with a funny name.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Oral arguments were heard this week in a court case challenging some of what's left of the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin is among the plaintiffs in the case. Meanwhile, health care may prove to be an interesting balancing act for candidates in the upcoming midterm elections.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and founder of the Center for Health and Wellness Law. She's also a regular Lake Effect contributor, and she joins us now to talk about what's going on this election season. Welcome back to the show.
It's been a while. Thanks, Mitch. Good to see you, too.
There's a lot that's taken place since we last spoke. There has been a whole lot that's taken place already in the area of healthcare and health and wellness law in the year and a half that the Trump administration has been in office. So as people look at the midterm elections that are coming up in just a couple of months, not even a couple of months at this point, how pivotal do you think they might be in terms of the direction of health policy from here?
Very, very pivotal. A lot of things are happening right now because of the people who are currently in power in both at the state and federal level. And so if you like what's happening now, then you're going to want to, you know, vote to keep people who are currently in place there. And if you don't like what's happening now, then you want to maybe look at other candidates who might be able to change the course or the direction that things are going right now with health and wellness law.
And it's interesting because I've read in just recent days there are plenty of states, Wisconsin possibly among them, where there are people who, you know, parts of the electorate that are generally happy with the kinds of things that the current administration has said or done. But at the same time, the one thing that they're really concerned about is maintaining their health coverage with pre-existing conditions, mm-hmm. say.
Right. I mean, that still is a very popular, when you poll the entire United States, even among Republicans, there's a majority support for keeping protections against pre-existing conditions. People want to be able to get health insurance coverage even if they have a pre-existing condition like cancer or some diabetes or some condition that might either make getting health insurance impossible or impossible to afford. If you are one of those people in the majority who want those protections against pre-existing condition exclusions, which was the case before we had the Affordable Care Act, then, you know, you're going to want to look closely at what's happening right now with, for example, the lawsuit that's being brought by 20 different states.
Right. And Wisconsin among them.
Yes.
Walk us through what that lawsuit is challenging and what's at stake here.
So it's the lawsuit. The name of the case is Texas versus United States. Texas was the first state to have this idea of suing the United States.
Right, they're challenging the constitutionality of this, right?
The constitutionality of the remaining portions of the Affordable Care Act. So if everyone remembers last December when the tax reform bill was signed into law, one of the big victories that, you know, the Trump administration and Republicans generally put into that bill and is now law is the elimination of the individual mandate, the tax that people would have to pay if they didn't buy health insurance. The bill, the law, just got rid of the tax, the money that you would have to pay. The language, though, that says that you still should be buying health insurance is still part of the law. And the 20 states, Wisconsin included in those 20, has said that, you know, if the money part is gone, then the requirement that people buy health insurance, along with the other requirements that are tied to that mandate, should also be gone. It's unconstitutional to have provisions that are tied to a tax that when the tax is no longer there in the law. So 20 states, Texas, the leading state, Wisconsin, our attorney general decided to join this lawsuit, as well as 18 other Republican-led states, have sued the U.S. government for having a law that they think is unconstitutional. The Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional now that this tax has been eliminated by Congress in last year's tax bill.
And so depending on the outcome of that case, it's not just that language that goes. It's basically the rest of the law as a whole.
Right. So that's the debate, is how, if the court in Texas, so the case is being heard in a Texas court, if the judge in that case decides to cut just portions of the Affordable Care Act, for example, the pre-existing condition protections, the guarantee issue, community rating, it could be narrowly construed, so only those portions might go away and the rest of it would remain. But my understanding is from oral arguments, which just happened last week, is that the states that are suing were arguing for full elimination of the entire Title I, which also, you know, had other insurance reforms that would go away.
Things like the pre-existing condition coverage.
Well, I think that's one of the main things they want to go away. But other things like what you have to cover as an insurance company, you know, the different rating structures, the different benefits that have to be offered, lifetime limits, lifetime caps, those things they also want to go away. The exchanges, all that would go away if the plaintiffs, who are the states, would win their lawsuit.
And of course, the climate for this is that the states are suing a government whose administration is not especially friendly to the Affordable Care Act in the first place.
Right. So the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice, has said that they aren't going to enforce or defend the Affordable Care Act, I should say, which they would normally do because it's the United States and they represent the United States. But they've decided, the Department of Justice under the Trump administration has said, no, we agree with these 20 states who have brought this lawsuit. We agree that the Affordable Care Act should be found unconstitutional. So we're going to actually be in support of the states that are bringing this lawsuit. So who's defending the lawsuit? Who's defending the Affordable Care Act? Are 16 Democratic-led states. They've intervened in defense of the Affordable Care Act, and they're the ones who are arguing, and who argued last week, for keeping the Affordable Care Act and declaring it constitutional, even without the tax that's been eliminated.
Even as this is going on, there are rules that are being put into place regarding short-term health plans and association health plans.
Yes.
What is going on there?
So this past summer, the Departments of Health and Human Services, among others, have issued rules to allow for short-term health plans. These plans don't have to comply with any of the Affordable Care Act requirements. They don't have to offer comprehensive benefits. They can underwrite and charge higher prices if you are not healthy. And they were meant, under the Obama administration, to only serve you for like 3 months. But under these new rules, now you can have these plans for up to 3 years. States still regulate them. But depending on, you know, your state's politics and policy preferences, your state may allow them for 3 years. If you have people who in the administration who are like the idea of short-term health plans, or you might have people who would want to restrict their use. Because the concern, of course, for those who are looking at the entire individual health insurance market is if you siphon off people into short-term plans, the people who are going to be in those plans are going to be healthy. And the remaining people who will want the comprehensive coverage that's offered through the federal exchanges will be less healthy, and therefore their premiums will go up. So
this is the ultimate issue when it comes to providing health care for everybody, how to do it in a way that, you know, doesn't unfairly burden put the burden on either side of the
right,
equation.
Exactly. I mean, when there's discussion about premiums going up, it's unaffordable since the Affordable Care Act, really what you're talking about are those people who are healthy, and they tend to be younger, and their premiums, yes, did go up on average. But those people who were less healthy, who have chronic conditions and need to see the doctor quite often, their premiums went down because of this community rating concept. And the lawsuit that we talked about in Texas, if the plaintiff states win, you know, that community rating would also go away. So then you'd have lower premiums for the healthy and higher premiums for the less healthy again. So that's what's at stake.
There's also something that had not necessarily been on my radar, and that is an opinion that the Department of Labor has issued when it comes to whether employers need to pay their employees for workplace wellness activities?
Yes. I found that interesting. So, you know, I talk a lot about workplace wellness programs. That was what my book was about.
Right.
And the Department of Labor just recently in the last couple weeks issued an opinion letter to an employer who asked, okay, in our employer wellness program, we ask employees to attend health fairs and do wellness activities outside of work, and if they don't do it, then they have to pay more for their health insurance or they get dock in pay. And our question to you, Department of Labor, is do we have to pay our employees for their time
spent? Are they on the clock?
Yes, doing those activities, because there's been a question. And the Department of Labor said, no, you don't have to pay your employees for that time, even though you're incentivizing them with premium reductions or paycheck reductions to do with them. It's not on your employer time that they're doing it. It's for their own benefit, the employee's benefit, not your benefit, the employer. So because it's not benefiting you, the employer, it's only benefiting the employee, they shouldn't have to get paid to do those activities.
Does an opinion from the Department of Labor have the same impact as a law, or is this something that could also end up in the court system?
It could definitely end up in the court system. It doesn't have the same legal weight as a statute or a rule that, you know, where there's notice and comment.
So this is guidance that they're providing.
It's guidance. It's reflecting the policy choices of the current administration. So again, we go back to the midterm elections. If you like these kinds of things, then you want to keep the people who are making these decisions currently in power. If you don't like these kinds of policy decisions or actions, then you're going to want to vote for new people.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She's the founder of the Center for Health and Wellness Law, which is based in the Madison area, and she's our regular health policy contributor. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee Fashion Week officially kicks off this evening. We'll talk with a designer who got her start in the Cream City and went on to big things nationally when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The fourth annual Milwaukee Fashion Week opens this evening. It features 3 days' worth of design shows at the Pottawatomie Hotel. While it's a big deal for the designers and local companies who will be showcasing their work, fashion and design are a big deal year-round for many students at Mount Mary University, which has a long-standing fashion program.
That is where fashion designer Donna Rico studied before making her way in the business and founding her well-known dress company. More recently, though, she stepped away from the New York-based company, and today she is sharing some of the lessons she gained along the way with students at her alma mater, where she's now an executive fellow working with the fashion design program. She's also joining us every so often to share her experience. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
So I want to flash a little bit back to history and then look forward. We talked a bit about this the last time we chatted, but I'm kind of curious. You know, you're a kid growing up in Milwaukee. How did your own eye for design and style and fashion develop?
Well, it developed quietly. I didn't really realize I was developing an eye for style until I started to work in fashion and everything came together. But as a young person growing up in Milwaukee, I always loved sewing. I was passionate about looking through pattern lookbooks, and I learned about, you know, the various designers and the clothing that was available to sew. And that's really how I started to develop a feel for fashion and style by looking at those images and getting very excited about them. I also love to go shopping, and I love trying things on and looking at the different proportions, experimenting with color and fit. And I learned a lot about style just from working with it, having fun with it.
Is there a certain amount of intuition that has to play into it, that, you know, after looking at stuff and trying it on and making it, after a while you just sort of get to know what works well together and what doesn't?
Well, it is intuition, and it's kind of like knowing intuitively what's pleasing and what's right. And it's not just about, for me, it's not just about fashion. It's really about everything. Looking at a room, looking at a work of art. I just have a feeling that I know when it's right.
Do you have to know people also?
Well, certainly people are important in many ways in developing a sense of style. I'm a real observer of people. I love people. I love talking to people and listening as well. You can learn a lot and understand, you know, why someone chooses to wear what they wear, in this case, fashion. And I respect that. That's important information.
You're working in an academic environment. In fact, it's the academic environment where you did your formal training, if you will. Do you have to figure out maybe what you can teach and what really can't be taught, at least can't be taught in a classroom?
Right. Well, there certainly being in a classroom is important, I think, in any area. You do have to learn the basics, the skills, the rules, really, in any area of study. And in fashion, those would be pattern making, sewing skills, fit techniques, fabric quality and characteristics, color theory, history of fashion. All of that is necessary to learn, I think, and it doesn't come naturally.
Yeah, and so, I mean, your title is executive fellow. You're not teaching at Mount Mary, but maybe you are.
Well, it's not formally teaching. I was talking to my mentor at Mount Mary this morning. Every new employee has a mentor, Sister Marilyn Kessler, and I've talked to her in the past through the years, and she's wonderful. And she asked me the same thing, and I said, well, I'm not really teaching. I'm advising. I'm a resource. And she said, and I'm critiquing in the classroom. And she said, well, ultimately, you are teaching. So I guess I'm teaching in some way.
So I guess then the question is, as you interact with students, and we should say you're really just sort of at the beginning phase,
yes,
of this. What do you tell a student about, you know, what they ought to expect from their formal schooling versus what they're going to have to figure out either for themselves or once they land a job somewhere?
Right. Well, first of all, it's not easy being a fashion student, because if you choose to be a designer, for instance, you do have to learn those basic skills. And not every fashion student is interested in sewing or loves to sew. But so I would encourage them to have, you know, to stick with it. And you do have to know enough about it to be able to be a better designer. But I would advise anyone who's thinking about getting into fashion is what you come with would be your passion for fashion or art, some ambition to want to work in this field. Those are things that can't be taught. Discipline, certainly, resiliency, and that intuition to know that once you have those basic skills that you've learned in school, your intuition can help you to break the rules and to understand, you know, how the people in the world works and how that can affect, you know, what you're creating. And I think that's an important thing that, you know, students should understand. There is a reason for school. You need the tools. But from there, it can launch you, you know, into your career. Confidence, which is gained by experience. I'm a big fan of experience. How can you become confident until you've made those mistakes, you know, and accepted them and learned from them and can confidently, you know, move along?
If I remember your own story correctly, part of it was being in the right place at the right time and getting the ear of the right people. Having been in the field now for the number of years that you have, do you see, has the career ladder changed at all for people who are getting into this field, or is a lot of it still being at the right, being in the right place at the right time and getting the ear of the right people?
Well, the way fashion is marketed and made and sold is really different from when I was a student and launching my career in fashion. I think that though, you know, students today have social media and the internet, and you know, I tell them when I visit the classrooms, I say, please try to look, you know, put that away, put your devices away, and just take some time to think about who you are and why you're here, and you know what your opportunities might be. I think that it's harder for a student today than it was for me because you have all of that information bombarding you. And it's even more important for someone to take that time to reflect and understand, you know, what are my passions? What do I like to do in fashion? You know, not everybody who studies at Mount Mary becomes a fashion designer. Some people become product developers. Some people become merchants in the fashion merchandising program. You learn about trend and line plans and you know, building a collection. So there's a lot of opportunities for them. But with social media, they've really, there's a lot more.
I wonder if one of the upshots of social media is, and I'm going to try to make this question not sound like, you know, these kids today, but I wonder if one of the upshots of social media is that there are young designers or people wanting to go into this industry who maybe think they have it all figured out before, you know, at a much younger age than you might expect someone to actually have had it all figured out.
Well, you know, that's the interesting issue with social media is that you there are people that started at a young age, you know, in their bedroom taking, you know, making videos of themselves talking about fashion or beauty or whatever it is. And it's all well and good. You sort of develop a cult of personality in doing that. Which is a great thing if you can take it to the next level. Many of those people do start to develop a brand, and they may say, well, I'm going to make a clothing line. But the reality is they're not designers. They haven't had the training. And they may have the idea, but they do need someone to assist in carrying it out. And I think that's a big opportunity for today's grads to understand that, you know, that experience gained by working with someone who's smart, who knows what they want, but they need to have it come to fruition, and they need someone to do it, is a great opportunity for grads.
I'm curious how much of what you have done over the years has been guided by what you learned, what your own intuition was, your own instincts, if you will, and how much of it was directed by what you saw consumers wanting.
Well, it's in my situation, in my career, it was very important to listen to the consumer. Building a brand doesn't just happen with an idea that one has. A brand is built by experience, listening to your customer, understanding their needs, filling those needs, you know, respecting them, and then having them come back and want to buy more from you. And that's how a brand is built. And it's a really exciting opportunity, an exciting experience to live life that way. It's a challenge. It's for me, it was great because I love interacting with people and going in, you know, doing a trunk show and being in the fitting room and listening to their desires and their, you know, looking at them and seeing how things fit to help them, you know, flatter the parts that they want that are flatterable, if that's a word, and, you know, to maybe disguise some of the areas that they don't want to show. So ultimately, you have to listen to the customer, understand what they want, and then make them feel really good about themselves, you know, wearing the clothes.
You just said you really enjoy the experience of going to a trunk show and doing this. One thing that I think you were not a big fan of was the full-on fashion show. What was it that did about those that didn't speak to who you were, who you are, and what you're about?
I think I certainly respect a fashion show, and I think that the idea of them has changed drastically through the years. I love an old fashion show. I follow sites on Instagram that will sometimes have a clip of an old show.
So what was the difference? What were fashion shows formerly about that maybe they're not now?
Well, back in the, you know, back in the day, they were about the clothes and the beauty of them and the fabric and the way that, you know, they were worn, I think. And it was about really selling the idea of the clothing as a real item that you could wear. And I think what's happened in a lot of cases today in a show, it's more about the pageantry and the excitement and the, again, you know, what is the purpose of the show? Is it to, you know, back, you know, early, in the early days, it was more about selling your product to the store, to the buyer. You know, they didn't really sell as much directly to consumers. Now, designers can, you know, they have those opportunities. It's not even so much about selling to the store. It's more about going direct to the customer. So it's a big expense. And really, the way that my business was, it wasn't necessary to have a show. We had a showroom, and the store buyers would come to the showroom every month and view the line. Certainly, we'd have a model in the showroom and to try things on so they could see how things looked.
In the middle of all this is Fashion Week here in Milwaukee, which is one of the reasons that you're here while you are, and
right.
And Mount Mary being a key player in the fashion world here. What are you hoping that either you or Mount Mary students get out of this this week that begins soon?
Well, Milwaukee Fashion Week is really an exciting opportunity for Mount Mary and its students because, you know, as an institution, we would like to partner and collaborate with some of these events, these fashion events that happen in Milwaukee. So Milwaukee Fashion Week showcases local designers and their products. And it's a really exciting opportunity for our students to volunteer as dressers, as runners. Mount Mary hosted a rack check for Milwaukee Fashion Week, which meant that all the designers brought their collections to Mount Mary, and our students and some faculty analyzed them and had a checklist, and they had to pass certain quality points. And that was really great experience for our students because we do the same thing internally. We have a big show at the end of the school year. It's called Creo. And it's a great way for our students to showcase their own work. And working with Milwaukee Fashion Week, they get that experience to learn what's expected of a designer.
And for you being in this industry, I imagine it will be interesting to see Fashion Week play out in a much smaller setting than in Paris or Milan or New York.
Well, it's a lot easier for the buyer or the consumer.
Parking should be
case.
Easier anyway.
Right, and you don't need to be Ubering all over to multiple locations to see all the designers' work. It's all one runway, and it's a really exciting event, and I'm anxious to see some of the creativity that's coming out of the designers in Milwaukee.
Donna Rico, thank you so much, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Milwaukee native Donna Rico is a fashion designer and an executive fellow at Mount Mary University. You can find a link to more about the 4th annual Milwaukee Fashion Week, which begins tonight, at WUWM.com.
There's much more on offer over the coming months in Milwaukee. We'll preview the fall arts season with Milwaukee Magazine's Lindsay Anderson when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Even if it's not official on the calendar, for all intents and purposes, it is fall in Milwaukee, and that means the area's arts organizations have begun their new seasons. There are big titles and some lesser-known ones on offer, from concerts at the new Fiserv Forum to small gallery shows.
Milwaukee Magazine previews the fall art season in its current issue. Cultural editor Lindsay Anderson joins me now to talk about it. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi, Bonnie. How's it going?
It's going great. How are you? It is fall.
I know. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. It's always my favorite season.
Well, and as the culture editor, you get to kind of look ahead at the cultural season and what's really kind of sticking its head up over the parapet, you know, to say, wow, this is really something to pay attention to. Before we get into specific recommendations, how did the magazine put this group together? It wasn't just you that wrote everything.
Right. Well, the challenge is always that there are so many interesting organizations putting on shows and exhibitions. So really, the challenge is always just sort of whittling all of this great material down and deciding what we wanted to include. So, of course, we want to make sure to include heavy hitters like The Rep, The Skylight, the Milwaukee Ballet Company. But we also try to look for smaller theater groups or dance troupes or art museums that are putting on sort of quirkier, interesting shows, or shows that are a little bit further off the beaten path that people might not think to go to, but are exceptional in some way as well. So we try, to include a mix.
Do you have interesting editorial meetings where everyone's making a case for, because you had about five people.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yes. And everyone has slightly different taste.
Which is actually good.
Right. I think that's one of the best ways to go about it. You want someone who maybe loves opera and is fighting to get lots of opera shows in, and someone who's a little more leery of it, who wants more sports content or something along those lines. So,
speaking of sports content, let's talk about that for a minute, because that is actually included in here. And so are you thinking of that as a cultural event rather than a sporting event?
Yeah, we decided to include entertainment as a category just because there are so many events going on around town that don't neatly fit into one of those more obvious cultural categories. And because the Fiserv Forum has just opened up, there's so much going on there. We felt like we needed to sort of tip our hats to
the
forum.
Okay, so we do have the Bucks and the Fiserv Forum as part of this. But we also have, as you say, the heavy hitters, the big games in town. But we also have some, you know, galleries and other things. And I wanted to start actually with visual arts because Tori Folliard Gallery is having a retrospective of Fred Stonehouse. And, of course, he is one of the grand old men of Wisconsin art.
Right. He's been active in the Milwaukee art scene for decades. He has a very unique style. And I think what's great about him is that his paintings appeal to longtime art collectors and people who are very immersed in that art scene, as well as people who might not feel quite as comfortable stepping into a gallery. They're quirky. They're figurative. He paints interesting sort of cartoonish, colorful characters. I think his work really appeals to everyone.
I was going to say it's very approachable.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he doesn't have a wall between him and people viewing his art.
Right. And he's an approachable artist, too. And I believe he'll be at the opening for that show, too.
Oh, that'll be great. Yeah, he is a lovely guy to sit and talk with and more than happy to engage people as well. You also have Sculpture Milwaukee, and this is in its second year.
Right. We just sort of give a brief overview of the exhibition. We make sure to hit the fact that it's free. I think a lot of people don't realize it's out there in the open. Anyone can walk along Wisconsin Avenue and check out these sculptures. And then we also tried to touch on the fact that there are some Wisconsin artists represented, some up-and-coming emerging artists, but there are also a lot of blue-chip big-name artists. Kiki Smith, for instance, is one of the most successful female sculptors in the United States. She's got a work in the exhibition this year. So there's just lots of great art by lots of really influential artists.
And as you say, it's just there.
Yeah, right.
You know, thanks to the folks who coordinated all of this, you can just go out and enjoy
it. Right, yeah. If you're in downtown and you have 20 minutes to wander around, it's a great way to just sort of kill,
It runs from 6th Street to
almost all the way to the lakefront, yes.
Yeah. So you can take it in chunks.
Yeah,
you don't have to walk the whole thing.
No, that's true, yeah.
So, well, moving from visual arts, let's look at dance. You've got a number of interesting dance things featured featured here. Of course, the Milwaukee Ballet, let's start with them.
Right.
They are getting a new home. I mean, it's going to be a while, but they have broken ground.
Yes, they're looking into that. So that's something that's exciting on the horizon for them. Also this year, one of their principal dancers is retiring. Luz San Miguel is an amazing dancer. So she's going to be dancing her last performance with the company this year in Dracula, which is fittingly the first show she danced for the ballet company as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's a nice
circle. So she sort of come full circle.
And anyone who's seen a ballet performance in the last however many years has seen her on stage.
Right.
Even if you don't know her name,
absolutely,
you've seen her dance.
Yeah, she's one of the most iconic dancers with the company. And she's not going away entirely. She's still going to be staying on as a teaching artist, helping other dancers and helping Michael Pink with the choreography.
That's terrific.
So I think that one will be especially exciting to see.
And
for sure.
Is that happening right around Halloween?
Yes, it is, which is fitting.
Yes,
and I think that'll be a fun show, too, because it's a story that everyone knows. Again, even if you aren't necessarily especially familiar with ballet, you know the story of Dracula. You'll be able to follow along. It'll be accessible, I think.
Well, and then there's some other smaller companies that you've focused on as well. New Dance Makers was one that kind of popped out for me.
Sure, yeah. UWM has a great dance department. And this is sort of their chance to spotlight up-and-coming student choreographers and really give them a chance to shine a spotlight on what they've been working on. So anyone who goes to that will be able to see some of the youngest dancers in the city sort of trying out new material, finding their footing, really finding what works. And some of them, I expect, will go on to extraordinary dance careers. So.
Bigger and better things. Yeah. Well, moving from dance to, let's go to music.
Sure.
And of course, right at the top of the list right now, because of all the construction going on down on Wisconsin Avenue, is the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. I mean, they have continued on. They have not slowed down their performance schedule, but they're building out their new home.
Yeah. I think we're all excited to see what that new space looks like when it's ready. In the meantime, like you said, they're still going to be performing, putting on shows in the Marcus Center. This season, I think one of the most exciting ones is going to be Rachmaninoff's Second Concerto. He's a famously difficult composer to play, so you've got to bring in a conductor who really knows his stuff. Musicians have to spend a lot of time rehearsing, practicing, getting all of those notes right. So I think that'll be a very technically difficult but rewarding show.
Do we know who the pianist is?
Yes, it's Boris Giltburg.
Terrific. That should be an amazing. I mean, Rachmaninoff is so florid and big and takes up the entire keyboard for the pianist. And of course, the orchestra has an equal part to play.
Absolutely. Yes. I think it'll be a fabulous show.
So what are some of the other musical things that maybe aren't classical? I know present music is in its 35th season, is that right?
Yeah. And founder Kevin Stahlheim is going to be retiring, so he'll be doing his last season opening concert. And then also on the pop music side of the spectrum, now that the Fiserv Forum is open, there's going to be a lot of popular musicians coming in. Justin Timberlake is playing for the first time in 15 years in Milwaukee. And the space looks beautiful, so I think that would be a great venue for concerts as well.
Do you know who the first concert is coming into the Fiserv Forum?
The Killers and the Violet Femmes actually played last week, so it's already
happened.
It's
already
happened. Yes.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah. I got a chance to see it. It was, it was pretty great.
Epic, as they say.
Epic is the perfect word for it.
All right. And so theater, lots and lots and lots of theater. We have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to theater companies in this town and wonderful actors and directors and scenic artists doing their thing. Obviously, the Rep is doing In the Heights.
Right.
Huge, huge, huge thing. Lin-Manuel Miranda is like the guy right now in musical theater in this country. Besides that, as epic as that is going to be, what are some of the other things that popped up on your radar for theater?
Well, Skylight, I think, always does a great job, especially in terms of putting on family-friendly, fun shows that anyone's going to feel comfortable going into. And this November, they're putting on Hairspray, which is one of my all-time favorite musicals. It's just a lot of fun, super catchy songs. Lots of color, lots of fun choreography.
Yeah, so if you've ever seen the movie with Ricky Lake and John Travolta, you'll know what the story is. Christopher Walken, I forgot that he was in it, too.
It's a fun cast.
Such a fun cast. And it is a delicious show.
Right, yes. Yeah. Delicious is a good word for it. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend that one. The Florentine is also celebrating its 85th season this year, so I would encourage opera lovers to go check out one of their shows, too. They've got a show called Prince of Players coming up in October that's about a male Shakespearean actor who makes a living performing female roles, because in Elizabethan times, women, of course, weren't allowed to perform. And then the king flips that edict on its head, and he's got to sort of reassess his career.
And it's also written by Carlisle Floyd, who's one of opera's great living composers. I mean,
yes.
I think the man's 90 now or something like that, and he's actually coming, I understand.
Yes, absolutely. And, I think that's interesting, too. I think that people have this perception that opera is something that was big 300 years ago that people don't continue to create. But no, there are modern works too. And there's a lot of great stuff going on this fall. So I'd encourage everyone to get out and check out at least one of those shows.
Well, Lindsay, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie.
Lindsay Anderson is cultural editor at Milwaukee Magazine, whose fall arts preview is in the current issue.
We will take one last break and then learn Wisconsin's role in the history of a sport called pickleball. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Pickleball has nothing to do with pickles, but here in Wisconsin, it is a big deal. Jokes aside, this once niche sport has surged in popularity, especially here in southeast Wisconsin.
According to the USAPA, the number of places to play in the country has more than doubled since 2010. One such place is just north of Milwaukee, and a company which is spearheading the effort. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi takes us there.
If you are unfamiliar with pickleball, you've still got time to jump on the bandwagon. It's like mini tennis or giant ping pong, depending on how you look at it. Basically, it's a tennis-like game played on a badminton-sized court with a paddle that resembles a giant ping pong paddle and a plastic ball similar to a wiffle ball. Got it? Good.
It's a game that most people can pick up very quickly.
Neil Friedenberg is the owner and CEO of ProLite, a pickleball company based in Port Washington. He's led the company for 7 years, but the sport itself dates back to 1965, when Congressman Joel Pritchard and friends created it, almost by accident, on Bainbridge Island, Washington. The origins of the game's unique name, like many stories, have been embellished over time. Common lore would have you believe the game was named after the Pritchard family's dog, Pickles, but in reality, the game preceded the dog. The name actually comes from a boating term, pickle boat, which refers to the last boat to finish a race. Often compiled from a crew of leftover oarsmen, the pickle boats reminded the Pritchards of pickleball's inception, when Joel cobbled together badminton rackets and a wiffle ball to invent a new game. While it started as a sport for older people, increasingly pickleball has surged in popularity among all age groups, especially as a sport played in schools. The sign in front of ProLite's Port Washington store, rather than featuring the company name, simply reads, "Play pickleball." Friedenberg has some theories on why the game is growing so rapidly.
What's happening is a lot of the tennis courts or fitness centers are implementing pickleball programs. That's number one. To have a place to play is kind of the barrier that most communities overcome. And then they see just all sorts of ranges and ages coming to those courts to play.
Commonly referred to as old farts tennis, the sport of pickleball struggled for a long time to overcome its reputation as a sport for old people.
The main thing I see is it's not what is pickleball anymore. It's people saying, "Oh, I've heard of that," or "I played in gym class." And, you know, it's part of the curriculum in many school districts across America. Therefore, you have access to it when you're young. And I think that affects, you know, the growth of pickleball amongst the different age generations. You know, it used to be thought of as that old person sport for a long time. It kind of hindered the growth, I guess, among the youth. But now when they're playing it so early on in their lives in gym class, with friends, you know, and even outside of class, now that there's places to play, that's what's happening. There's a youth movement.
Friedenberg learned the game when he was young, about 11 or 12. He first played the game with his father.
He kicked my butt. I learned very quickly not to, you know, underestimate anybody. But what was fun was we were laughing, going back and forth. The rallies were long. That's what's amazing about the sport. The rallies get very long, and there's this intensity. And then it comes back to that dinking or slow play, strategic play. That's what I was seeing when I was playing back, you know, in the 80s. And, you know, it wasn't popular, so I still played the other sports and kind of put down that paddle.
But Neil's passion for the game lingered, and he eventually took over the company in 2011 and moved it from Washington State to Port Washington. Back in 1984, ProLite was the first to make the composite paddle, which offers a lightweight alternative to the wooden paddle, reducing arm fatigue and providing more control, precision, and power. ProLite is able to tailor their paddles to players' individual needs and backgrounds.
We like to match up paddles, weights, shapes, the playability and performance to someone in background like racquetball, tennis, table tennis.
For a pretty simple game, the paddle science can get pretty complex.
We have different types of cores, and honeycomb cores is always a standard, it seems, ever since it was developed by ProLite back in 1984. It brings down the weight. It's very durable. And then what comes with that is a different type of, they call it skin or facing or face sheets. There's graphite, there's fiberglass, there's polycarbonates, there's carbon fiber. All of this affects the ball a little bit differently. We enjoy being nerdy. It's a passion.
For Neil, pickleball has always been more than just a game. So it's no surprise he sees ProLite as an ambassador for the game. Recently, he made a trip to India, where he met up with his friend Manish and his pickleball crew. They spent time traveling throughout the country, playing recreationally and putting on clinics in Mumbai and Jaipur.
I don't think I'll ever forget that trip. We went up to Jaipur, which is a little more northwest in India, and we are in Finland. It's the game spreading in Europe and Sweden and Spain and Mexico. You know, it's really going to start spreading rapidly because, like you said, it's accessible, it's attractive, it's adding years to people's lives.
For Friedenberg and ProLite, pickleball has become a global endeavor. But back home in Wisconsin, the game is growing as well.
It's becoming more popular in different communities. You know, you can look right around here, very small town USA, in some of the spots, and some of them are the first to have dedicated pickleball courts.
So far, the sport has largely been a suburban and rural phenomenon. But Friedenberg is optimistic that is changing. Most racket sports have a history of exclusionary policies that have made games like tennis a game for higher social classes and white people here in the U.S. He says since pickleball is a much newer game, it doesn't share in that history to the same extent and has the potential to be a much more accessible sport.
I see it growing. I think it's going to be, right now they estimate about 3 million people are playing this game. That's just an estimate. There's probably people playing off the grid here that are not accounted for. 10 million people within the next couple of years, I think, is very realistic.
Some of those players are picking up the sport at the Brown Deer YMCA, where Steve Smith teaches pickleball lessons. He also teaches classes for Milwaukee Public Schools' Active Older Adults program.
Pickleball, I love pickleball. And my wife, her eyes glaze over when I start talking about it because I get real enthused about it. Basically, for me, it's just a fun form of exercise. You know, it's a fun game with a funny name.
Because of the small size of the court, the lightweight paddles, and the fairly simple rules of play, pickleball can be played by a wide range of people. I asked Steve what he would say to people who have never played the game before.
Okay, well, the first thing is they have to try to get past the name. I think there are some macho guys that say, hey, I'm not going to play that. That sounds stupid. Once you hit the ball, once you've played just for a half hour with anyone, if you just participate, you'll find that it's just super fun. I mean, I do use some of the ellipticals and treadmills and stuff like that. But after an hour, I'm looking at my watch, and I thought, whoa, it's only been an hour. But when I play pickleball, I can play for a couple of hours, and the time just flies by.
Despite its growth in schools, here at the YMCA, the pickleball population definitely skews towards older players. Older than me, for sure. Steve Ward is 71. He's been playing for about 3 years. Tall and lanky, the former college basketball player has a dominating presence on the court. But he says he still has a lot to learn.
I'm still learning, and you can learn something new every day.
Steve says he observes other players and tries to incorporate their skills into his game.
I learn from everybody. Everybody here has something they do quite well, and they may not know it, but I watch, and then I try to do some of the things that they do. Every single person here has something they do well.
I asked Steve what I do well on the court.
You have the speed, endurance, and really the power that most of us don't have.
I assured Steve that he has something I will never have, wisdom.
We have age. With age, you learn a lot. And the main thing you learn with age is that you can learn something new every day. You never know it all.
What do you like about the game?
I like that it can be intense, but you can get a good workout, and yet it is not as demanding as tennis, where you have to stroke the ball properly in tennis. Here, you just get it back, similar to ping pong and badminton.
In addition to the social benefits of the game, pickleball also provides players with various health benefits. According to a recent study of older adults in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, people who regularly play racket sports were 47% less likely to die of any cause and 56% less likely to die of cardiovascular disease. Darlene Baker plays pickleball to help her cope with the form of tuberculosis.
I play pickleball, it helps my lung capacity. But I've known a lot of people that have various issues, whether it's asthma or, you know, running or their hearts, a lot of heart issues that play pickleball to get better. At one time, when I lived here, I could only play one game out of three or four. Now I can play almost every game. So they told me to do the treadmill. I couldn't do it. I literally couldn't do it, but I can do this.
While Darlene comes for the health benefits, she stays for the company.
And the people are all nice. I don't care where you go. I've played pickleball in Ohio, Missouri, everywhere, and people are nice.
Yeah, am I up?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
My paddle was next in line, so it was my turn to give pickleball a spin. Full disclosure, I've played pickleball more than a few times before, and don't plan on showing any mercy to my elders. And they wouldn't have it any other way.
The young people are okay. The main difference is the young people have better legs, more stamina, and they're a lot quicker than the rest of us. But we accept that.
If nothing else, pickleball keeps these people out and about, interacting both with people their age and also across generations. I'm 23, and I don't normally spend a lot of time with older people, besides my grandparents. Indeed, there aren't many social circles where older and younger people can be on the same playing field and interact. But this is one of them. For some, pickleball is just a fun game with a quirky name. For others, it's a way to stay healthy. A form of exercise, playful competition, and community. Hopefully, as the game continues to grow, it will continue to bring people together. For Lake Effect, I'm Ben Benversi.
You can read more about pickleball, see photos, and more at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next.